Hey y'all, welcome to episode 4 of the Outlaw History Podcast. Not gonna waste a lot of time this week, we're just gonna get straight into it. Follow me on Twitter at Outlaw Historian. If you want to get involved with the Patreon, go to patreon.com/outlawhistory. Today I'm sitting down with a good friend of mine, colleague, Dr. Cheryl Coulthard, and we're gonna talk about her research on utopian societies. Utopian communities in the 19th and 20th century United States. So, let's just get right into it, y'all. Finally, we were supposed to do this a couple of weeks ago, and we had to rain check because I was having a panic attack over grading. That's grad school. So here today with one of my good friends, my colleagues, one of my cohort, Dr. Cheryl Coulthard. She has a BA in History and Religious Studies from the University of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. An MA in Library and Information Service from Texas Women's University, an MA in Teaching from Texas Women's University, an MA in History from Sam Houston State University, and of course, a recently defended PhD at Texas A&M University. How are you doing, Cheryl?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me.
Very, very happy to have you. I've been trying to have you for a while now.
So, what do you want to talk about?
You're Canadian.
I am.
Tell us about that. That's so bizarre.
Why is that so bizarre? There's lots of us down here. There's 40,000 Canadians in Houston.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I've been down here almost 14 years. So.
How do you all not melt?
It's a struggle, especially like today when it's 85% humidity.
So, are you from Manitoba?
Winnipeg originally.
You're from Winnipeg and went to University of Calgary.
Yeah.
What's your first memory of developing an interest in history?
Oh, gosh. Probably middle school is when I started being interested in it. My mom was always interested. She read a lot of historical fiction, books I probably wouldn't even look at now because they're not that historically grounded, shall we say. But it was always around me. We went to a lot of museums when I was a kid. Historical sites, that sort of thing. My dad was really into history. When he retired, he worked at the Museum of the Regiments in Calgary.
Yeah, I consumed just gobs and gobs of historical fiction as a kid. I don't have the time or the patience for it now, but that seriously stoked my enthusiasm for history. I have a well-documented obsession with John Jake's North and South trilogy.
Yeah.
And also the TV series that it spawned, but the book trilogy is, you know, my favorite novels ever. So what was the first particular subject that really grabbed you?
It was British history. I was always really interested, particularly Tudor history. That ended up being my topic in my master's. But I was just really interested in kings and queens and great person history in Britain.
That's the way most people start.
Because I always felt like Canada lacked history in the way, and to a certain extent, the U.S. as well, compared to Europe. We don't have as many hundreds of years of interesting history.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask it because I imagine that most of my readers are Americans. Can you tell us about what kind of historical education do you get growing up in Canada?
I would say similar to what you see in the U.S. in that it's more, there's regional history initially in elementary school, and then to middle school you get more national history. It gets repeated a lot year to year like it does here, and then you do world history, so where Canada fits into the world. We don't do a lot of U.S. history. I think just about everything I knew about U.S. history came from Schoolhouse Rock.
This may be my experience, but it seemed, at least in my experience, it was we would have American history over and over again. We would alternate American history and world history every year from, you know, middle school to high school. And my world history classes, I don't remember there being a heavy emphasis on U.S. and the world. I never even considered that as a concept until grad school, because it just, most of what I would think of as U.S. and the world, we would get in American history, but it tended to be a very sort of jingoistic narrative. Do you have this trope in Canada where your school history teachers are just sports coaches on their off time, or no. Is that a strictly American thing?
I wouldn't say it's strictly an American thing, but it's not required of history teachers the way it is here. So, for instance, my sister teaches middle school social studies, but she also teaches phys ed and she coaches, and that's her choice to do that because she enjoys it. But I never had a coach as a teacher growing up. But sports in Canada are much, in school, are strictly like intramural sports. There, you know, you have football and that, but it's not the obsession it is here where a coach, a high school coach, coaches 6 periods a day.
If you went to public school in America and you never had a history teacher that was a coach, tweet me at Outlaw Historian. I want to know your story because I really don't believe that you exist.
I do know they do exist because I have some friends that are not coaches that teach history. But one of the reasons I went back to get my doctorate is the year I got my teaching certificate here was the year they froze hiring for teachers. The next year they laid off 29 teachers at the school I was at. Mm. And then when they started hiring again, it was a requirement for high school teachers to teach or to coach. And it was coaching baseball, football, boys basketball, which makes it very difficult right. as a woman to get a job as a history teacher.
Yes,
now.
And I know obviously there are history teachers who aren't coaches. I meant that everyone who went to public school in America, I don't think anybody got out without ever having a history teacher yeah. that was a coach. In any particular interest that sort of developed in your undergraduate, you had a double major in history mm-hmm. and religious studies. What in particular during your undergraduate years really grabbed your attention and pulled you deeper in?
Well, history in those days was very Eurocentric.
In those days?
Well, much more so. I took two classes in my undergraduate degree that were not European history. And there were maybe three offered. They just weren't there. It was very, very Eurocentric. In fact, I didn't even take a Canadian history course, although that's required now for history majors. My religious studies major, I did comparative religions because I think the interplay between religion and history is really important to understand.
Absolutely.
So I've done a lot of work on Reformation history, so that just kind of emphasized that. So when I came down here, I had taken one history course in U.S. history when I moved to Texas, and that was in Civil War history.
Excellent.
From a little old lady from Ohio who started off the year telling us that Lincoln was God.
And was this in Canada?
This was in Canada, yeah. That was my one and only U.S. history course.
I mean, she's not wrong.
It was just an interesting introduction to Civil War history.
Yeah, I am the world's biggest Lincoln fan, but yeah. I don't think I will start my Civil War class that way. No, I might dust off my Shelby Foote accent and talk about what a genius Lincoln was, but...
Well, we were all convinced that she knew him personally. Although looking back at it, she's probably about the same age I am now. So perspective changes, you know, when you're 18 years old, all your professors look ancient.
Yeah, I didn't have that quite as much. I was a little bit of a non-traditional student, so I was in my early 20s, but I wasn't a teenager anymore when I started college, so I didn't have that particular problem. So tell me about you mentioned your MA research, or your MA in history, because you have three MAs. And didn't you tell me once that was you didn't have a work visa for several years, so you just went to school?
Well, yes and no. So when I left Canada, I've been working. I've worked a whole lot of different jobs in education. I've been a special needs paraprofessional. I've been a school librarian. I've taught everything from preschool up to adult ed. So the whole range. But the last job I'd had was as a school librarian, and that's what I wanted to do in Texas. And when I moved here, I had a visa that allowed me to go to school and live here, but not to work. So I did my library science MA first, because to be a school librarian in Texas, you need to be a teacher and a school librarian, but you can't do your student teaching without a work visa, even though it's unpaid. So I did my library science and then my teaching master's in about 3 years total. And then I student taught and then got my certification and then the hiring freeze. So after a few years of struggling to find jobs and being told that you'd be perfect for this job if you'd be willing to coach football, I decided to go back and do my master's in history. And I focused on European history mostly. I did do some work on Latin America. I needed three fields, so. And I did take two courses, one in women's history and one in civil rights history. So that was really my introduction to American history there.
Tell us about your master's thesis research project.
So my master's research was looking at Anne Boleyn's influence on Henry VIII's Reformation.
Yeah, tell us about it.
So there's a number of discussions about Henry VIII's Reformation, how much influence was driven by Henry, how much it was written or driven by different people at his court. But there really hadn't been anything looking at Anne Boleyn's influence on him. And she was quite a religious radical. And there's evidence of books that she gave him to read, some of which were illegal in the country at the time, that Thomas More was torturing people basically because they had these books, but she was giving them to Henry to read, and there's annotated copies of those. And she had some influence on shaping how he did things with his Reformation in terms of, okay, if you're going to take this money away from the church, what are you going to use it for? We need to be doing more to help the poor. And things like that, where she was helping to shape it, it was more than about just the divorce.
It's really interesting. And I'm not a Europeanist, and I am definitely not an early modern Europeanist. But I find it interesting to consider Henry VIII's Reformation as part of the larger Protestant Reformation, because it's concurrent, but it seems like, based on the narrative that I have gotten, it's concurrent, but it's kind of unrelated. Not that it actually is unrelated, but it seems like the way that I have been taught about that to the limited extent that I have, that it's more disconnected from the larger Reformation movement. But it's not, right?
Well, and being in England, of course, it is physically, geographically separated. And England, people forget, was really kind of a minor power at that time. We think, you know, Henry VIII is someone that gets a lot of attention, so people assume, oh, he's this big, powerful king. But really, from a European perspective, he was just a minor power at the time. But his Reformation was running more or less concurrently with what was going on in Europe. And in both areas, part of the changes that were going on were driven by a political desire for these smaller political leaders to gain more independence from the church or the Holy Roman Empire and assert control over their own territory. So that's part of the struggle that was going on. And then there's also a change in terms of kind of a democratization through the Reformation, in that people are getting more access to written materials because of Gutenberg, and because things were being translated into the local dialects so people could actually read them, and getting away from these layers of hierarchy between the people and God. So there's this democratization process within the church as well.
So in a way, the Reformation is sort of a product of a decentralized Europe that's a collection of all these different kingdoms and duchies. And
I would, in some ways, it's a driver of that decentralization, because it's breaking up power as well. So breaking up the Spanish Empire, for example. So Holland gets independence during this period, and you get breaking up of the whole, to a certain extent, of the Holy Roman Empire. And there's more drive towards smaller powers having independence that really don't start coming together again into countries until the mid-1800s, when Germany forms as a country and Italy forms as a country, and that those changes are happening.
This might be a little bit beyond the scope of your learning, mm-hmm. but the unification of Italy, does that significantly reassert the sort of broader authority of the Catholic Church?
I don't know that that changes it really, because Italy was always more Catholic. All its different parts were more Catholic than, say, Germany. So the Catholic Church continues to have a lot of power, but it unifies it from city-states into a central authority.
Starting to look at how you transition from that into your doctoral research project, how did you go from thinking you were going to be a Europeanist to being sort of a de facto Americanist?
There's a few factors. One was, to continue the research I wanted to do in European history, I would need French, German, and Latin. I have French, very little German at the time, and no Latin. So I looked at it and went, that's probably not going to happen to get that level of competency to be able to do the research I wanted. It was also access to archives, whether or not I could get the information I wanted. So I started thinking about what my interests really were. And really, my interests were more focused on people that reject social standards, that kind of live on the fringe for various reasons, whether it's religious or political or social, cultural, whatever it is. And an interest in social movements and how people respond collectively to change. And I had read a book in a modern European course for my master's that was about a Russian assassin, a woman, a Russian assassin in the 1860s.
No, this is not the wrestling jobber tag team, the Russian assassins from the
80s. Okay. No.
Just making sure. There is some cross-pollination between my audiences, so I just want to clarify.
This was in the 1860s, and what fascinated me is they talked about this woman's life and the people she was working with on this assassination project, and she was living in a commune, and it sounded just like a 1960s hippie commune. It was communal property, free love, shared labor, shared childcare, all the kinds of things that are kind of markers of 1960s hippie communes. And this was happening in Russia under an authoritarian government in the 1860s. So my initial thought was, well, was anything going on like that in the U.S. in the 1860s? And how did those two periods compare in terms of that? And it kind of developed out of that.
So I wrote down the title of your dissertation just because it's a lot of words. The Quest for a Utopian Solution to Social Problems of Race, Gender, and Social Inequality, a Connective Study of Communal Societies in the 19th and 20th Centuries.
Yeah, I ended up changing the title into something else, and I'm trying to recall what it was. What was it? Liberating Ourselves.
See, I would have gone with Hippies Through Time.
Yeah.
You can use that for the book. Free and clear.
So, yeah, I ended up with Liberating Ourselves, a Study of Utopian Communalism in 19th and 20th Century United States.
We have the same PhD advisor, Dr. Lorian Foote. Obviously, I work with her because she's a fantastic Civil War historian. I would imagine a lot of people don't know that her dissertation research and her first book was on, it was Robert Gould Shaw's father. I can't remember his name, but you know.
Henry? I think it's Henry. It's called Seeking One Great Solution. It's basically about social, our reform movements in the 19th century. So Dr. Foote had background and interest in reform movements in that period, and that connected with what I was looking at. So that's how I ended up working with her. But that's always a question people say when I tell them, or ask when I tell them I work with Dr. Foote, is, but you're not a Civil War historian. You're not a military historian. That's true. I'm not. But she has multiple interests.
She is extremely capable. I've actually been sitting down to read The Yankee Plague, and it's so good. As soon as I get my proposal done, so she's happy with me, I want to get her on the podcast to talk about it because it's a fantastic book.
I have it on my summer reading list. That I have time for that.
Very good. I'm really impressed with her ability to turn a phrase. Game recognized game, I guess.
Create a compelling narrative.
It is. That's something that I aspire to, and I've been very fortunate in that my two main mentors as a historian were both just really fantastic writers, and I imagine that helped me a lot. So tell us about the dissertation. Tell us about how you conceived the project and how you got into it, the research you did. Tell me everything.
Well, I mean, when you sit down to write a dissertation, you come into it not really knowing what you're going to find in the archives. I mean, this is true of any research project. Right. You don't really know what you're going to find in the archives. You have questions that you want to ask, and you have maybe some ideas of where it will go, but it never really works out exactly the way you plan. So you end up finding information that sends you in new directions or causes you to ask other questions. So I started off with this idea that communalism was something that we tend to think of as being a 1960s, 70s thing, but has been going on for a lot longer than that. And I was interested in how did those periods compare in terms of who was joining these communes. What was their purpose? What was going on in society that they were responding to? What did they get out of it? How well did it work? Those, you know, all those sorts of questions. And what I developed into was kind of, it's really two projects. And when I move forward to publishing this, that's my plan, is to split into two books, because one's more a theoretical project looking at communalism as a social movement as opposed to a set of isolated phenomena. And then the other project is an intersectional study of utopian communities looking at questions of race, gender, and class, and how those communities attempted and failed or succeeded in trying to address those issues.
Can you give us a teaser, maybe a sort of an elevator explanation of what is the nature of communalism?
Well, when we're talking about utopian communities or communal societies, intentional communities, there's lots of different names that get used. And essentially, it's a group of people who are not related. I mean, there may be couples and children, but that's not the organizing principle of their community, that have chosen to live together and share, to some degree, their resources. And as a utopian community, the ideal is to make a better life either for themselves or as a model for broader society. So really, it's about finding a better way to live. It's a response to concerns about changes that are happening in society. So right now, a lot of communities are focused on climate change and ecological concerns, healthier living, sustainable living, and how to create a better life for themselves
apart from that. Some groups look at the damaging effects that capitalism has on the working class and how to find a way either to create a total alternative that is like a barter system or a communal system. Others operate within capitalism but create a more sustainable, more humane form of capitalism for their community by controlling their labor and their means of production, and then they sell that production out into the world. So they're still participating in capitalism, but doing it in a way that is better for the laborers. A lot of them address issues to do with genders, so either equality issues, the dynamics of the nuclear family, how we raise children, monogamy, those aspects of life and society.
I like intentional society. Mm-hmm. I think that's good.
That's a term that kind of came into use post-70s when there was, as American society moved into a much more conservative phase, and there was a real demonizing of the 60s. If you look at historiography from that time period, it's very much the 60s is to blame for everything that's happened since then. You know, the breakdown of the family unit, the rising divorce rates, drug use, lack of respect for institutions, those sorts of things all get blamed on the 60s.
Well, as I'm sure you know, the 1860s also caused a lot of problems.
Exactly. So as in a response to that, there have been intentional communities in this country since, you know, John Winthrop and the City on the Hill. But going all the way forward, communities have kind of rebranded themselves. And because there was also a big anti-cult movement in the 70s, they didn't want to be associated with that. So choosing to rebrand themselves as utopian communities, intentional communities, something that gets across the point that they are living together, but with intention. They're not just people that just happen to start living together. There's a purpose to what they're doing.
Absolutely. I get it. Branding yeah. is very important. I've been working hard on my branding. So you did a sort of a connective study, mm-hmm. you called it, on utopian communities in the 1860s and the 1960s. Give us an example of a utopian community from the 1860s and what they mean to your larger perspective on okay. intentional societies.
So I looked at three groups from the 19th century. I looked at Harmony Society, which was around from roughly 1805 to 1905 and had hundreds of members. It was very large. I looked at Neshoba, which was a very small, short-lived community in the 1820s to about 1830 that was interracial and was started specifically with the purpose of finding alternatives, a way to get away from slavery and to prepare the people that were enslaved for living in society. So
where was the
Tennessee, just outside Memphis.
What happened?
Oh, boy. So the idea, Frances Wright is the person who started it, and she was an associate of Robert Owen, who was a philanthropist and social reformer in this period. And she started it with the idea that obviously slavery was a great evil that needed to be ended. She spent a lot of time talking to plantation owners, talking to people like Thomas Jefferson and James Monroe, James Madison, Andrew Jackson, all kinds of kind of prominent men, and developed this project with the, it was sort of a pilot project that she invested her own money in. And the idea was that she would bring slaves there and they would be educated and trained, given skills, and they would work side by side and live side by side with the white people in the community to prepare for emancipation. And she didn't have an opportunity to just emancipate them in Tennessee at that time, so she resettled them to Haiti. Haiti was a new republic, mm-hmm. and the president worked with her to sponsor these formerly enslaved people. There were about 30 of them she ended up resettling there.
Have you seen, is that episode, has anybody looked at it as a part of the broader recolonization movement?
So that's something I actually talk about in my dissertation, oh. Is there is a significant difference with the, say, the American Colonization Society, which was started, I think it was 1816. The goal of it was basically they recognized that if emancipation happens, we're going to have all these formerly enslaved people out in society. They don't have skills. They don't have the education, the cultural understanding to assimilate successfully. So their solution to this was, let's ship them back to Africa without considering where they may have come from, how many generations removed they were from Africa, whether it was their desire to do that. But ultimately, the difference between their project of colonization and Frances Wright's is that she had hope that it was possible to assimilate slaves that had been emancipated into white society, that what it took was education and, I guess, acculturation to bring them together, that this was possible. She even, at one point, promoted or at least supported miscegenation as a practice because she believed that over time that would break down those racial barriers. So needless to say, that didn't go over well. 1820s Tennessee, that was not a popular idea.
I still think that, by the way. For the record, everyone should intermarry until we're all the same color and it doesn't matter anymore. But that's just one man's perspective. So those were your two communities?
The third one I looked at was called Modern Times, and it was on Long Island in 1840s to roughly mid-1860s. And it was designed to address economic issues primarily, although there was a free love component to it as well. It was an anarchist community. One of the founders, Josiah Warren, is kind of known as the first American anarchist. He wrote a lot on individualist anarchism. So just to distinguish there, what he was talking about is getting away with coercive institutions and basing society on voluntary association. Very distinct from maybe the popularized idea of anarchism as these bomb-throwing people that are trying to violently overthrow the government.
So I have to ask, because I'm me, this is the Civil War era. How is the larger national situation affecting this community?
So that community was really divided over the Civil War because, of course, there's always the patriotic duty, but that was at odds with the idea of coercion. Should we be coercing the South to behave in a certain way? Isn't it in line with their beliefs as anarchists that the South should be able to secede if they don't agree? So there was a real philosophical conflict going on. Some members did go and fight in the war and others did not. But it definitely caused them to re-examine their beliefs as anarchists.
Did that affect the dissolution of the community?
The dissolution of the community had more to do with lack of strong leadership. This is kind of a typical problem that anarchist communities get into, is if you don't have leaders, how do you get people to do the things you need to do?
The Confederacy had the same problem.
Well, right. So, and some communities work really well on a consensus basis, but you'd have to be pretty small typically for that to work well. Mm-hmm. But it just got to be a problem if people don't want to conform and to behave in the ways that are socially acceptable, then do you still accept them in the community? And if you try to coerce them or shape their behavior, aren't you violating your beliefs of an anarchist?
Interesting. So jump ahead to the 20th century to tell us about that end of the...
So I looked at three communities in the 20th century. I looked at the San Francisco Diggers, who were also anarchists, and they were directly addressing issues of capitalism, consumerism, materialism in Haight-Ashbury in the 60s. So they set up projects to feed people. They'd go around to stores and collect all the unused food that they couldn't sell the produce. And they'd make these huge pots of soup and stew and give it away in Golden Gate Park. They had bakeries set up that they baked bread to give away to people. They had stores where people would donate stuff they didn't need and you could come and get whatever you wanted, like a thrift store, but no charge at all. So they did a number of things like this to address issues with this kind of post-World War II consumerist society and just challenging, you know, the standard hippie approach of challenging, you know, the 9-to-5 job, the social standards around sexuality and dress and all of those sorts of things as well. I also looked at People's Temple, Jim Jones community, which a lot of people don't realize started in the 50s and went to the late 70s, and that there were people that survived Jonestown. And I thought it was interesting to look at that group because of the way it ended, and people focus on the horrible outcome at Jonestown, right?
Right.
Where you've got hundreds of people committing suicide or being killed. And their goals as a community, because nobody joined that community with the intention of going to Guyana and killing themselves. They joined that community because they thought they were building a community based on interracial harmony and economic equality and sexual equality. Those were their goals going in. So they were utopians. Now, it didn't turn out the way they intended it to, but their goals were utopian. So that one I thought was interesting to look at because of the way it came out, and to shift the focus away from one day in 1978 back to the decades before, where they had actually been actively working in their community. Jim Jones was actually lauded by evangelical groups and community leaders across the country because of the work he was doing in inner city San Francisco. Now, he had serious, serious problems and inflicted horrible behavior and abuses on his community.
Okay, this may be an ahistorical question, mm-hmm. but I just want your perspective. Was he initially sincerely utopian, or was he just pulling a con?
Well, it's really hard to know. He had, from the very beginning, had an interracial church in Indianapolis in the 50s. So that was always one of his professed goals. But to know whether he thought he was doing it as a con is harder to know. You know, getting inside people's heads is really difficult.
It reminds me of, like, wasn't the Westboro Baptist Church guy, hadn't he been like a civil rights attorney?
He might have been. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Apologies to the family of Mr. Phelps if I've given him credit that he doesn't deserve. But I think that's right. What was the third community?
The third community is called Carista, and it was also in San Francisco, and it was there through the 70s and 80s. And it also had this authoritarian, quasi-religious leader. It was very much a free love community. It was really complex in a lot of ways that I'm still digging into, because they had a multi-million dollar Apple resale business, which is not what you think of as a hippie community doing.
Apple the fruit or Apple the computer?
No, Apple computer.
Okay.
Business. They had a rock band. They had all kinds of different businesses that they conducted. They had this, how to describe it? They called it a religion. It's a religion, a philosophy with goddesses and very transcendental in a lot of ways. approach to religion and understanding. What they're probably most known for, or get the most attention for, and I have a comment about that in a second, is their sexual practices. So they had within the larger group, they were divided into family groups essentially, and they rotated partners on a basis like with a chore wheel.
Oh.
And they believe the reason they did that is they believe that that way they are forming bonds to the community. There aren't personal bonds that they are being put before the community. And the idea was to break down jealousy and to break down interpersonal ties that would interfere with the functioning of the community. So they were on the Phil Donahue show and did interviews. They got quite a bit of press at the time. What I struggle with is there's a tendency to portray these communities as, you know, oddballs, freaks.
Right.
And I think that distracts from their serious intentions. If you focus all the time on the things about them that you maybe think are strange or that wouldn't work for you, it detracts from looking at these are people that have identified problems in society and they're working out different solutions to try and solve them. So I struggle with how much attention do I pay to these things that are really interesting, but sometimes a little out there, and giving them the right kind of attention for taking on serious projects. So it's kind of a balancing act.
Give us just your short and simple answer of why does this matter?
So we have problems in society.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
And we can go with the inside-the-box solutions and keep trying the same thing over and over again and not getting anywhere with it. Or we can look outside the box and see how these communities have chosen to take a different path and try different solutions that in some cases have worked really well for them and learn from that.
I like the way you think. Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up here?
I guess what I'm trying to do going forward is to work on bringing attention to some of these projects and putting them in context so people understand them, not as these standalone groups that are doing things that are different or maybe odd and not acceptable or whatever, and balancing that with how they fit into the greater context of how we move forward and how social movements contribute to creating positive change in society. So that's my focus going forward.
It's very important work. And I have to own the fact, since you're on the podcast, I have to acknowledge. So we were the same cohort. We started our doctorates together.
We did.
And you, in fact, defended your dissertation the week before I passed comps.
We're all starting from the same point, but as I've told you many times, we all have our own journey to get there. Mm. So, you know, we have things going on in our lives. We have different priorities. We have different challenges within our work. So we follow our own path and we all get there eventually. And I have no doubt you will too. Well,
you did fantastic. And I appreciate your support and friendship over the years.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate yours.
Thank you so much for doing the podcast. I think this is really good. I think people are going to love it.
Okay. It's been a pleasure, Trey. Thanks.
You don't do Twitter. Do you have anything you want to plug for me?
Not at the moment, but...
Okay. Tweet me @outlawhistorian that you want Cheryl on Twitter, and I'll screenshot them and send them to her, and maybe we'll get her.